Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for July 26th, 2018, the Pay with Cash edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I am secretly recording John Dickerson of CBS This Morning in New York. Hello, John. I'm secretly recording you.
Oh, you are? Oh.
Yes.
Well.
It's a secret.
Then do it in cash. But no, wait, a check. Or no, a cash.
No. I'll take care of it.
Pay with cash.
Emily Bazelon of the New York Times is in New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
Not secretly recording you, because I think Connecticut's a two-party consent state.
I think you're right, although I'm not totally sure. You know, I just never turn on the tape recorder without asking permission, I don't think. It just seems like the wrong thing to do.
Yes, it does. On this week's Gabfest, Michael Cohen's secret tape and what, if anything, it means. And then a Trump-endorsed conservative wins the GOP primary in Georgia and sets up the most exciting governor's race of 2018. Then a truly dismal stand your ground case in Florida. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. Michael Cohen, president's lawyer, this week released a surreptitious and cryptic recording of a conversation between him and then candidate Donald Trump from, I think, September of 2016. In the audio recording, which was probably legal under New York law, Trump appears to be going along with a plan to pay $150,000 to the National Enquirer to buy from the National Enquirer rights that the National Enquirer had recently bought to a story, to the life story of Karen McDougal, a woman who claimed to have had an affair with Trump shortly after Melania Trump gave birth to their son in 2006. Whew, that is, it's very soap opera. It does not appear that Trump ever paid this $150,000. It is also not clear to me, at least, what Cohen is trying to accomplish by leaking the tape. John, based on what you've heard and you've read, is it clear what is happening on the tape or is it not clear?
I don't think it's terribly clear what's happening on the tape, other than that Donald Trump, whose spokespeople previously said he knew nothing about it and that he knew nothing about this arrangement, is heard on tape intimately discussing and coordinating the details of the thing about which he said, or his spokespeople said, he knew nothing. So that's clear enough. One of the reasons it's difficult to figure out what's going on is they've clearly had a previous conversation. He understands the code words that Cohen is using, the president does, because the conversation without any previous knowledge would make no sense at all, because Cohen is saying, I'm going to set up a company. First of all, just stepping back one more sentence, it's a very relaxed conversation about things like setting up companies, making $150,000 payments. If this were a new information or a complete out of left field attempt at extortion, you would imagine many other people would think, what's going on? What do you mean set up a company? Like you'd be a Gatling gun of questions. None of that is there, really. But what we don't really know all of the things that the president knows in his head, whether I didn't hear any evidence one way or the other about whether he agrees with the underlying charge, which is to say, is he arranging the payment because he knows this is true and he wants to make it go away? Or is he arranging the payment because it's extortion, it's totally untrue, but he doesn't want to fight it because it's September of 2016, and if the story comes out, it'll be damaging. So this is just, it's a big sunk cost for him. I couldn't tell any of all of that. And then there's other weird, he seems to be on the phone with somebody else at the beginning, which is somewhat interesting. The Washington Post has some speculation about that. I don't think it's worth being highly speculative, and we don't really know. But he has another side conversation in the middle of it, so that all contributes to the fuzziness.
So, Emily,
what about the pay with cash line? What did you guys think that was clear or not clear?
Well, I was going to ask you that. That was basically my question that I was about to ask you, which
well,
is...
Well, I'm asking you, because we both have ears.
Okay, so there's the question of, is Trump saying to pay with cash? That's number one question. Number two question is, if he is in fact saying to pay with cash, what are the legal implications, possible legal implications of that? So, look, I'm not an audiologist, and nor did I expose myself to forensic analysis.
Is that a thing? What's an audiologist?
Someone who studies hearing.
Oh, okay. Wait, studies hearing? Okay.
Like, you take your kid to an audiologist if you're worried that it
well,
can't
I know,
be,
but why would you need term. To be an audiologist to just, like, listen to this? I mean, I think it's hard to figure out what's going on.
It was just
on.
A term. I was just using a term to imply somebody who's not scientific about hearing
the wrong
things.
Term, like, and it suggested on, that we all are... had to have a medical degree in order to just, like, listen to this thing.
What I'm saying is I have not done forensic analysis on this. It's very okay. cursory. Okay. And so, to me, it doesn't sound like he is saying don't pay with cash, but
no.
that's – but I'm – That, but the, beyond that, I don't really have an opinion.
Also, isn't the big issue whether this is a violation of campaign finance laws and whether he pays with cash or pays with barter system or drachmas or whatever? That's the issue at hand, not this side issue of cash versus credit, right?
Well, except that Giuliani said that Trump was saying, don't pay with cash. And it is not at all clear that that's what he said. So in the sense that it's
that
like, yet one more time or...
Right, but that's less important than whether this is illegal and he can be prosecuted for it, right?
True, but the obfuscating and lying is...
If you're, I mean, just on the lie scale, there's the big lie, which is that he didn't know anything about it. But I'm interested in your take, Emily, on the campaign finance challenges.
I mean, I don't think that it is in itself evidence of a campaign finance violation because, as you said, we don't know whether this payment got made. Should they be, like, closely looking into this? Yes, absolutely they should be. You know, one question is whether David Pecker and the National Enquirer and American Media, what's it called? AMI, what's the I stand for?
American Inc,
Media
probably.
Incorporated. And America Media Incorporated were acting in their press function or doing some other thing, which could be an illegal campaign donation. And I certainly think that this whole, you know, catch and kill arrangement, if it was for the purposes of helping Trump win the election, looks like it could be a campaign finance violation. Whether Trump himself contributed to that and made it happen, that's trickier. You have to know, like, you have to follow the money. And then I think the hardest part for prosecutors is going to be intent. How are they going to show that the rationale for killing, catching and killing the story was the election versus sparing Trump embarrassment or, you know, helping him in his marriage?
I know that we are not doing ourselves any favors here because we're talking about this as the first topic of conversation. But I must say that this story is strangely uninteresting to me. It doesn't tell us a single thing that we don't already know about him. We know he's an adulterer. We know that he pays people off. We know that he has shady finances. We know that they were playing close to the line on campaign finance stuff to begin with. It's not to say that it's not scandalous and immoral and disgusting, because it is. But it's not scandalous and immoral and disgusting in ways that we weren't already aware that he was scandalous, immoral, and disgusting. And so it's sort of like, it feels to me like something which we're spending a lot of breath on and is not adding to the common stock of knowledge in the world.
Well, I think when you have audio tape of something like this, that makes it slightly different because it's you hear him talking about a thing they said he knew nothing about. So that's on other things you don't have. I mean, sometimes you have his own audio tape that he contradicts later when he's audio tape like things he says at a press conference. But I think that changes it a little bit. Is the kind of fact that this was recorded in secret, and the biggest point, of course, is what it means for the legal case, which is that his fixer, the person who taped lots of phone conversations, whose job it was to manage these kinds of things, and who, given the tone of this conversation, obviously did this enough so that they had a kind of shorthand for how you make things like this go away. If the guy you employed to make things go away has now turned against you, which is the context in which this came out, then that's a big deal because he's got the keys to the kingdom, and those keys actually aren't even in his hands anymore. They're in the hands of prosecutors.
If this is the best he's got, that's not very good.
Well presumably
we don't know
the prosecutors
that.
Have a hell of a lot more.
What Michael Cohen decides to do next and whether what he's really doing is fishing around for a pardon is going to be super significant in terms of the legal investigation. I also felt like this having the tape was part of a week of Trump asking people not to believe what they were seeing or hearing and to believe him instead. And I know that this also is familiar, the lying and the obfuscating and the stating of falsehoods, but it was just a head-spinning week for that of, you know, the FISA court application comes out explaining the Carter Page surveillance, and it completely contradicts the Devin Nunes Republican version of what this FISA application was based on and supports the Democrats' interpretation, and Trump says the opposite. And there were other examples of that this week, and I felt like we were back in the moment right after the inauguration of the pictures of the crowds and being told to believe something that was not what matched what was in front of our eyes. So I guess you can say that's nothing new either, because we did know it. But at the time, that seemed trivial. And increasingly, it's just like part of the core approach of this presidency.
It goes without saying, John, that this is unlikely to be something that will move poll numbers in a significant way, unlike perhaps Helsinki did. Given that, what should the media do with this? And also, what should the public do with this story? There are so many other things that are happening, the tariff stories, the sort of attacks on Obamacare, the Endangered Species Act, the threats against Iran. There's a lot of both substance and smoke going on. With this particular story, what should we as citizens and we as media do with it?
Well, I think you should cover all of those things.
Even though you can't cover all of those things,
Depends the venue, right? I mean, so we just in what we do every day, we mentioned all of those things except for the Obamacare thing. And, you mention it, but then don't dwell on it, except to the extent that I think there's a moment. I think that one should always take note when the president is caught saying something that's that untrue. You know, where it's the situation is this stark. I think that should always be something that we flag, and so we don't think, well, this is just the everyday. This is the everyday thing. So I think it's useful to do that. I think it is. It's also interesting just as a part of this larger drama. But I think in this narrow venue, I think actually the emoluments ruling that came down on Wednesday, right, the judge that decided, I think, is this right, Emily, for the first time, basically defined what the emoluments clause means. The president and Justice Department were arguing that it means essentially a straight up bribe. And the federal judge decided, no, it can mean essentially what those who brought the case, the attorney generals of Maryland and D.C., what they think it could mean, which is basically foreign countries doing business with the Trump Hotel for the purposes of trying to gain favor with him. The fact that that's going forward is a huge deal, A, in and of itself, but B, again, to the extent that Michael Cohen is a can opener into a hidden part of the Trump world, the emoluments clause case could be a can opener into the finances of the Trump organization, much of which have been hidden by the president.
Great point. Yeah, totally. The ruling was great. It does feel like that it is real significance. I mean, Emily, just lingering on that for a second, I don't know if you've looked at it legally, but what is likely to happen with that case going forward, assuming the administration will appeal it, so it'll go to the Ninth Circuit, I mean, to the D.C. Circuit somehow, but what will happen?
I think it's actually in the Fourth Circuit because the case is in Maryland. And yes, it's going to go right up to the Fourth Circuit and there'll be an appellate court ruling. And I assume this case is going to the Supreme Court. And the question will be whether it goes right away in this kind of, preliminary pre-discovery phase, or whether it goes back to the district court and the discovery happens and then it goes up, which is a huge distinction in terms of, the kind of financial information disclosure John was just talking about. What's so interesting is that we have this part of the Constitution that's never been interpreted before by the federal courts. And so we're going to have a very historical inquiry about what the framers intended at the time. This is like truly an originalist question in terms of interpreting the Constitution. And the judge's argument that emoluments must have meant something separate from bribes, because otherwise, like, what's the word doing there, since the meaning of bribe was, commonly understood at the time of the framing? That seems kind of commonsensical. I haven't studied it, like, seriously, so maybe there's a counter argument I'm not thinking of, but it's pretty interesting.
Slate Plus members get bonus segments on the GabFest and on other Slate podcasts. You can become a Slate Plus member by going to slate.com/gabfestplus. And this week, we're going to talk about a very Dickersonian Slate Plus topic. The question is, would we all be more productive if we worked 4 days a week instead of five? Although, weirdly, for John, it would be like if we worked, you know, 6 days a week instead of seven. I don't think John
how about 7 days a week instead of eight?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
John likes to imagine the hypothetical. In any case, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to sign up and hear bonus segments and get all sorts of other Slate Plus goodies.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Brian Kemp, a Republican in Georgia, won the gubernatorial primary, or the runoff, this week. Kemp had started his campaign with a, quote, deportation bus tour. He taped an ad in which he pointed a gun at a teenage boy interested in dating his daughter. He proposed to round up criminal illegals in his pickup truck. And he coasted to victory over Casey Cagle, lieutenant governor. Kemp was the Secretary of State of Georgia, Cagle, lieutenant governor. Kemp won upon receiving President Trump's endorsement and also upon benefiting from Cagle's stumbles. Cagle appeared both bumbling and scheming in a series of secret tapes. This is Secret Tapes Week here on the campus. And now Kemp will face Stacey Abrams in the general election. Stacey Abrams, who won the Democratic primary earlier, would be the first Black woman governor in American history. It is shaping up to be a fantastic and fantastically interesting race. Emily, early polling has this race, even slight edge to Kemp, but it's so early, who the hell knows? But how is it even possible to envision a Democratic governor in a state that has been quite bright red for the past 20 years?
Well, so Stacey Abrams has this really interesting theory about a path to victory. And I feel like I've already disclosed slash bragged about the fact that I know Stacey from law school. So, you know, her theory is that there is this emerging majority in Georgia of young people and women and people of color, and they are underrepresented in the electorate. If you look at the percentage of them in the state versus the number registered to vote, it's too low. And that if they were registered to vote and they voted, they would have the power to carry this race. And so Stacey's been working for years on a project to register people to vote in Georgia. And one of the kind of crazy underlying themes of this, you know, as you said, like totally fascinating race, is that Kemp, as the Secretary of State for Georgia, was the person who was purging the rolls and blocking a lot of these registrations from going through and really making it just much harder for people to vote in Georgia. So the underlying dynamic and these questions about voting rights and how you register people and who they are and what kind of rules the state has to follow to purge people from the rolls, those rules and that fight could determine the outcome of this race. So I really hope they talk a lot about that, because that in itself is, you know, an issue I think that Democrats in particular could raise up in 2018 and 2020, this question of access to the ballot.
Emily, I only read this one place, and I don't know whether it's correct, but it did, the number I saw suggested that Abrams, who had set out to register hundreds of thousands of people, had only managed to register 46,000 people. Still,
yeah,
a nice,
and that's partly because
voters.
Kemp, right? But that's in large part because Kemp was not accepting a lot of these registration applications. There's been a lot of litigation over this going into the Georgia courts. Like, it's a tangled web, this story, and so that's all part of it.
Right, but just going to the electoral possibilities. So I think African Americans are about 37% of the Georgia electorate, and Abrams presumably will win overwhelmingly, 90%+, which means she needs about 30% of the white vote, was my back of the envelope calculation, maybe even a little bit less. And yet it's very likely she won't even get it, which is just incredible to think that the Democratic Party among white Georgians is so weak that it would be as low as that.
Right. Well, I think this is where it's going to be really interesting that the Republicans have a candidate who is such a model of the Trump era, and whether what effect that has on the white vote. There's also this question of who votes, who turns out, how many more people get registered, and whether that has some impact on reshaping the Democratic electorate. John, are you, what's your sort of like immediate, do you feel like it's too early to know how this race shapes up?
Well, I do. I like the, it's one of the fascinating races out there. In another thing that makes this race fascinating to me is that both candidates are really interesting to watch kind of outside of and separate from Georgia. And so it's the kind of thing where something that Kemp does, it's already happened, but will potentially reverberate outside outside the state. And obviously, that's why we're talking about Abrams's approach to it, too. I guess what I'm interested, what's connected to that is the extent to which values and identity are wrapped up in all of these symbols now in ways that are a part of Trump, but also separate from Trump, and how that plays out in a gubernatorial race. So national Senate and House races, you can kind of see, you see a little bit of a closer connection to Donald Trump. If the Democrats take over the House, they can investigate the president, they can investigate his administration, they can clog up the actions of his administration to advance a kind of national Democratic message. The Senate obviously has extraordinary power with respect to judges and so forth. So you get the understanding of the connection between Trump and the candidates. But in a gubernatorial race, and the issues are different. There's no real relationship in the ways I just described. On the other hand, when a candidate plays to these identity issues the way Kemp certainly has with guns and immigration, does it have a power that essentially does connect him to what Donald Trump has created and an energy he has created in the country? And so is he able to access the same Trump base, the same Trump feeling? And that's one of the things that'll be interesting to watch in this, which is going to be different than we've had in previous elections, where gubernatorial races can kind of not be connected to the national message.
There's this phenomenon that I first became aware of maybe 2 years ago called rolling coal. I don't know if you guys remember this, which is that people who basically conservatives who hated the environmental movement in this country created trucks which spewed as much pollution as possible. But it was to create huge amounts of black smoke coming out of your truck. And people were thrilled about it, and they took great joy. And it was really just to troll liberals and troll environmentalists by doing this. I feel like what's happening with the Republican Party is just rolling coal and kind of a political level. Is that if you look at what Kemp is running on, Abrams has a very substantive campaign. I mean, there's a strategic part of it, a tactical part of it around registration, but there's a lot of substance. There's a lot of policy positions that are interesting, and she talks about a lot around education in particular. For Kemp, there's nothing. It's an atavistic. It's symbolic and atavistic. It's all this, you know, Merry Christmas crap. It's respecting our troops. It's, you know, we're going to round up illegals. It's pointing a gun, you know, pointing the gun. It's weird the way it has devolved into just tribal symbolism. And I gotta hope, I mean, maybe I'm wrong here, that it's certainly, there's a huge portion of the electorate that's going to vote that way because they are Republicans. They believe in sort of what Republicans do. And also because they respond to this dog whistling. But at some point, the lack of any substantive positions is going to come back to haunt Republican politicians.
I wonder, though, if in Democratic politics, policy carries some of the identity weight that those appeals on the Republican side do, which is that Democrats some Democrats do anyway, self-identify as serious policy government works, mm-hmm. make government efficient so that it can help the maximum number of people, and that sends an identity message to Democrats in a way that I'm not saying that the motivations for doing it are the same, but that it may have ultimately a similar effect with Democrats.
And I think there's an identity strategy among Democrats too around a lot of civil rights issues and marriage equality, and which, you know, for me are human rights issues. And so I sort of feel it, but they do have that same kind of identity component. It feels on the Republican side, it feels particularly backward looking and empty and just about sort of fucking with liberals.
Well, yeah.
And it imagines this hostility.
Right.
Like, who is it that goes around? Nobody goes around saying, don't say Merry Christmas. Nobody goes around disrespecting our troops. That's a completely confected illusion. And yet it becomes this thing that people talk about and obsess over and make build campaigns on.
The two things in connection with that. Three things, I guess. So, right. It's whether Donald Trump endorses a candidate or not is, I think, doesn't have much power. I think if a candidate is seen, as Mark Sanford was, as an active agent working against Donald Trump, I think that can hurt people. But Donald Trump saying yes or no, I'm not sure how much power that has. But a candidate who mimics his appeals to fear, I think, can be successful. And what they are successful in part in doing, Adam Hamilton, a Methodist pastor, wrote a book that's just out, which is great, about living in fearful times. And one of his arguments is that in politics, Donald Trump has so freaked people out about the rising crime rates that it creates a kind of national anxiety that's not verifiable by the facts. But if you keep everybody hopped up, it may have a political benefit, and that clearly seems to be what Kemp is trying to do. Final point on your rolling coal, which reminds me a little bit of the expression "own the libs" and trolling, which is what Paul Ryan said the president was doing by saying he was going to revoke the security clearances of previous intelligence officials, is doing something that is basically just to make your opponents exasperated. Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, gave a speech to young conservative high school students in which she said, you know, owning the libs might make you feel happy, might make you laugh, may please you to do things just to make the other side uncomfortable and embarrassed. But that's not the right way to behave. That's not the right way to persuade anybody of anything. And it's not a sign of leadership. So that's interesting, because that's not exactly the strategy that the president she works for, or a number of people like Kemp in Georgia, that's not the strategy they're pursuing. However, there are some Republicans who think that's the dead-end strategy for the party, ultimately.
Emily, just going back to the point you made early on about Kemp as Secretary of State, there's just been extraordinary amount of incompetence and negligence involving Georgia and its voting systems. Significant evidence that secure data was left exposed. It was left exposed even after the state was warned about it, that voting systems could be compromised, that there's like passwords available. Kemp has dismissed this. There was, I didn't follow this exactly, but it seemed like there was a lawsuit filed. And as soon as this lawsuit was filed, the state wiped the servers that contained the relevant data for the lawsuit.
It was crazy. Wasn't this a story in The New Yorker by Sue Halper? And the story was nuts.
Yeah. I mean, so what mechanism is there? Maybe there's none. It's kind of surprising to see a Secretary of State say, yeah, it doesn't matter that our voting systems are compromised. It's favoring me. It seems weird that isn't something that a Secretary of State, even a Republican Secretary of State, Democratic Secretary of State, Green Party Secretary of State, isn't up in arms about it. It feels like a basic part of the job.
I mean, yeah. And look, there are many secretaries of state of all parties and persuasions who would see it the way you do. And there are good reasons for that. But there is another kind of breed of state secretary of state right now, like in the mold of Kris Kobach, in which you're not thinking about it that way. You're thinking in terms perhaps of partisan advantage, or if you want to just like take Kemp's rationale at face value, what he said about it was he was preventing federal intrusion. He was refusing to let, you know, there be any kind of help from the federal government at a time when the Obama administration was in power. And that was his excuse for not accepting the help of federal election officials or just like dealing with this in some way that seemed like it would be about protecting the integrity of the system as opposed to letting it be so vulnerable. I hope that he gets asked a lot of hard questions about that during the campaign, because it seems dangerous and increasingly dangerous based on what we know about, you know, how the Russians are trying to influence the 2018 elections. I mean, now we have Dan Coats, you know, Trump's one of his main security people saying we have red lights flashing. And this example of Kemp leaving these vulnerabilities in the system and then wiping it clean rather than investigating it and fixing it just seems like really kind of mind-blowing in that context.
All right. Well, this is going to be a super interesting race to keep watching. And I can't wait to see what happens. It's going to be fascinating.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
So let's turn now to a tragic and appalling case in Florida where a sheriff this week declined to push forward charges against Michael Draca after he killed Marquise McLaughlin in a convenience store parking lot. So, Emily, this is a case with people behaving badly, with an overreaction, and then a man ending up murdered in front of his children. So talk a little bit about what happened.
Well, there's a very brief surveillance video clip of this altercation, so everyone can watch for themselves. But a woman named Brittany Jacobs was in her car with her little kids, and she was parked in a handicap space outside the store. And Michael Draca came over to her, and we can't hear what he said, but presumably told her to move or complained that she was in the space. And right at that moment, her boyfriend, Marquise McLaughlin, came out of the store, heard what was happening, went over to Draca and pushed him. And it's a hard push. Draca falls on the ground. McLaughlin takes a step backward, I think, and yeah. Draca pulls out a gun, and as McLaughlin is backing away, Draca shoots him. And he died in front of his children, as you said. And the, you know, notion that Florida's stand your ground law could mean that this shooter, that Draca could face no charges at all, I think is what we're all trying to figure out. It seems like this just can't be the right answer, at least to me.
So, Emily, actually, so here's a moment where we can all take a restful 2 minutes while you give us an incredible disquisition on three really interesting legal concepts that have now merged. Two ancient ones, the duty to retreat and the castle doctrine, and now a third one that has overtaken them, a distinctively American one called Stand Your Ground. So tell us about each of those.
Right. Well, so, you know, traditionally we have in British law, which American law comes out of, we have a really strong notion of self-defense. If someone's attacking you and you think they're about to kill you or really hurt you, you're allowed to fight back. But we also have what's called the duty to retreat. And so the notion is that, you know, you don't want a world in which people in a kind of vigilante, like self-police force way, react aggressively when they're being threatened if they don't have to. We also have an exception to that rule that comes out of British law called the Castle Doctrine, which you just talked about, which is that if someone threatens you, they come into your home and threaten you, then you don't have a duty to retreat. And you can kind of understand that, too, because there's that idea that, you know, in your own home, you shouldn't feel attacked, that if someone enters it, they've kind of lost the right for you to have to get out of their way or move back to avoid the confrontation. What Florida has done is take this a step further, and now effectively you have no duty to retreat anywhere. So this parking lot became Michael Draca's castle, in effect. And what the law says is that the person who's using deadly force, the shooter, has a right to do so if he or she reasonably believes that using or threatening to use the force is necessary to prevent death or great bodily harm to himself or others. And so That's the standard in the law. It's caused all kinds of problems for Florida prosecutors. Florida police also tend to really hate this law because it, you know, has escalated conflict. All of that said, as misguided as I think, removing the duty to retreat in public is, I also think that the sheriff in Pinellas County is just completely misinterpreting the law here, because it appears from the video that McLaughlin was backing away. And so the notion that Draca felt like he was at imminent risk of death or bodily harm, I just like don't see that on the video. And to me, it just seems like an even broader interpretation of this stand your ground law than is necessary.
Right. So there's he did not have a reasonable fear at that moment.
I don't think so.
Right.
Right. And when the sheriff has gone on TV, he's talked about the sort of subjective fear. He's basically said, well, Draca says he feared for his life. But like that should not be the standard. It should be what a reasonable person have feared.
Why isn't it the standard ground a defense rather than a reason not to charge? Shouldn't it be something you can invoke in a trial? You're charged with murder and you use that as a defense. Why is it something which prevents a charge to begin with?
That's a great question.
That is not how the law works in Florida. And I don't remember if this is in the statute or it's based on how the courts have interpreted it. But instead, what has happened is that the state has to affirmatively prove that you did have a duty to retreat. So the burden of proof here goes to the prosecutor as opposed to you asserting it as a defense after your charge. That's part of the problem.
So, John, one of the extraordinary things about Stand Your Ground is that it has gone from not existing as of 2005. This was in Florida passed the law in 2005 to now 25 states having a version of a Stand Your Ground law. Why did this happen? Why has it been so relatively easy for the NRA and some of its conservative allies to get these laws passed?
Well, because I don't know the full picture of it. And I also want to go back to the details of the case, because I want to get your all's take on if the racial makeup had been different of the participants, whether the rulings would have been different. But I think that it's become the growth of concealed carry as a movement has been very successful for Second Amendment advocates throughout the country. It has had. And it's now obviously coming up as a potential federal issue with the concealed carry reciprocity legislation that's sponsored by John Cornyn and others. So this is a part of that, and it's a part of legislators who believe it, advocates from the NRA and other gun groups that are promoting it, and it's a part of the connection and what we were talking about in the previous issue, which is it's a way to signal to voters that you are that you are tough on crime, that you are a supporter of gun rights. You know, there are ways you can say I'm a supporter of gun rights, but then you can say and I want concealed carry and I want stand your ground. It's another way to show action on a core issue for an active set of voters who have shown that they will reward you if you act on their issues, and obviously reward you with votes, but also reward you with money.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. I mean, the NRA has been very effective at not just defending existing gun rights, but pushing for more of them. And these stand your ground laws, you know, the NRA has lobbied heavily for. And ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which writes laws, helps right-wing conservative lawmakers draft laws and pass legislation. They've been a big backer of these stand your ground laws. That's why they're spreading.
Actually, that leads me to I thought was a wonderful piece, and now I can't remember who wrote it. But making the extremely persuasive to me point that stand your ground laws are anti-conservative, that there was no problem with the law as constituted. We had a hundreds of year history across two continents of duty to retreat and castle doctrine being the way jurisprudence worked. It was the basic legal standard. There was no evidence there was a crisis of people getting killed and threatened out in parking lots because there was no stand your ground laws. And instead, legislators go ahead and pass this entirely new standard, which invites all kinds of crazy behavior. And the result is, in fact, that homicide rates go up. There are all kinds of escalated encounters. And it's when again, as a conservative person with a small C, it just pisses me off. It makes me furious. It's like you had a system that worked relatively well, that had been tested by hundreds of years of history, where there was no obvious problem that it was causing, and yet people go ahead and change it because it allows them to score a political point, and death results and mayhem results and, you know, also, you know, racial injustice results. It's infuriating. Let's go to the racial component of this. So, Emily, there's pretty strong. So we didn't mention this, but Draca is white and McLaughlin, the victim, is black. And there's pretty strong evidence that it's much easier to make a stand your ground kind of case, and you get much more leeway if you're white and you kill someone who is black than the reverse, right?
Yes, there is evidence like that, and it's really, really distressing and makes you feel like, even apart from the just wrongheadedness of these laws for the reasons you were saying, they are associated with higher homicide rates. I mean, amazingly, even in this moment where across the country homicide rates are coming down, Florida's is significantly up. So that's correlation, not causation, but it doesn't look like a strong sign that stand your ground laws are making people safer. So there's that whole kind of public health argument. And then there is this problem of racial bias and the way that it plays out in the system. And for me, there's a real parallel here with the death penalty, where, you know, whatever one's feelings are about the morality or immorality of the death penalty, the way that we apply it is racially biased. And it means that, you know, black people who kill white people, or especially if there's a white victim, no matter who did the killing, that's when we impose the death penalty. And similarly here, it just seems like these stand your ground decisions to decline to prosecute come about when you have a black victim.
It's interesting to me that almost nobody, not even conservatives, are really defending Draca. I think people are saying, the conservative line seems to be the sheriff has misapplied the standard, because have used the point you made, Emily, which is that he did not have a reasonable fear, and so the sheriff has misread the law. Nobody is sort of saying, yeah, Draca's in good shape here.
Right. And the state's attorney, you know, the prosecutor for Pinellas County, could still come in here and bring charges. And I mean, that's what I'm hoping will happen. But yeah, I mean, when I watched this video, I just, the idea that a fight over a parking space could turn into a lethal shooting in front of children in like broad daylight just seems terrifying. So maybe that's why you're having trouble finding people defending the shooter.
Although actually, I want to ask you about this, John. People behave in appalling ways around parking spaces and around handicapped parking spaces in particular. It is something that works people up really to an extraordinary degree. I mean, McLaughlin and Jacobs, who parked in the handicapped space apparently without justification, like, that's an asshole move. You shouldn't do that. It's the wrong thing to do, and it sets people off. I bet there are a ton of murders that take place over parking places, and I know there are tons of angry confrontations that take place over parking places.
Angry confrontations, no. Maybe. I don't think there are a ton of murders. And also, can we just like make sure that you are not veering into victim blaming? Because I am sure you don't think this person deserved to die.
Of course no one deserved to die. Of course no one deserved to die.
But I don't need to be saved.
I mean, the Draca is somebody who had confronted people over this very handicapped parking space before. I'm just saying that, in fact, right, people behave really badly around parking places, and it sets people off. People have a sense of ownership over parking places. And so if you think that's a space I'm about to take and someone else takes it, people get agitated about that. The handicapped parking place and the way it represents a kind of protected space, and then you see people violating it, that causes people to be agitated. I'm not at all saying, of course.
He's just seeking to examine a phenomenon in life.
Yeah. But John, I mean,
now, no, I think you're right about the conflict over parking spaces. Yes, people get exercised.
I would like to hear
places.
Also, John, I feel like you are somebody who, you are a great analyzer of human behavior under stress in situations that require decency. So what is it?
Yeah, well, it's like road rage. I mean, it's like the most acute, or one of the most acute ways, line cutting road rage, in which we kind of the general injustice, right, and airplane behavior, perhaps like seat reclining, the injustices, the larger injustices that we all feel outraged about from wherever we come from, kind of all distilled down into a sharp, pointy thing coming right at us, I feel like is part of what happens in these cases. I think also I saw some very strong reactions to Brittany Jacobs, who was interviewed afterwards, saying, I have the right to park wherever I want. That sentiment.
Did she say that? That's a mistake. She
yeah, shouldn't have said that. And this was subsequent to the shooting of her boyfriend. So that did not win, again, even from people who would feel embarrassed if anybody suggested that they were blaming the victim, nevertheless were incensed to hear her say that. So I think you're right, David, that this is, I mean, in some ways, this may fall apart as I say it, but here we go. To the extent that the Starbucks confrontation that we talked about a few weeks ago is that Starbucks became the location for a lot of other huge, massive societal things that we don't know how to wrestle with very well. And so that it was more than what happened in that actual store. It's a lot about the societal currents that just happened to appear in that store. And I feel like your point about parking lots and these spaces is kind of right. And it's sort of a surprise to me that there isn't more of this. Let me ask you the question about, I was unclear if the sheriff was sort of saying, sure, I would charge this guy, but my hands are tied. In other words, was it sort of, I don't know, Emily, there must be a word in the law for this, which is we just have to follow the rule of law, even though we all think it's makes no sense because, you know, McLaughlin was clearly backing up in the video and he was backing up the way it looked to me before Draca pulled any weaponry. I mean,
yes,
it's a pretty fuzzy thing, but
right.
It looks like he pushes him and then he immediately starts backing up. So, anyway.
Yeah, the sheriff, I mean, he did say something like, I don't make the law or something that absolved himself of responsibility. But because he seems to me to be making the wrong call, it's hard to not see that as like a paper-thin excuse, especially because he also pointed out that a few seconds elapsed between the shove, Draco falling to the ground, and then the pulling out of the gun and the shooting, suggesting, I mean, even the sheriff said it gave him pause, that because there was that space and time, maybe Draco didn't feel like he was, you know, under imminent threat. So it was like he was undermining his own rationale in the moment. In this way that was quite odd.
All right, let's wrap it there.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are having a cocktail at one of your parties, Emily Bazelon, what are you going to be chattering about?
All right. This is a sad one, and I'm sorry about that. But several years ago, I wrote about this incredibly tragic case in which a baby got very sick and ended up having seizures, you know, throughout his life. And the cause was mysterious. And his babysitter at the time, whose name is Trudy Munoz, was accused of shaking him and went to prison. And to me, it looked like a case in which the evidence that this was shaken baby syndrome was really disputed. Trudy was not a native English speaker. And when a social worker questioned her, she described jiggling the baby after he like collapsed. And that Spanish word got translated as her confessing to have shaken the baby, which does not seem to have been what happened. But in any case, it was this case that went to trial and led to a prison sentence, and all of the appeals that her lawyers filed were denied. So now Trudy Munoz is finally getting out of prison, but she is not an American citizen. She's from Peru, and so she is eligible for deportation. And because she has this felony conviction, once she gets out in August, it's entirely likely she'll be deported. And so this woman who you know, may well have been wrongfully convicted and spent years in prison is going to be separated from her children and her family and sent far away to a place where she hasn't lived for many years. And the only remedy left is a pardon request pending before the Virginia Parole Board and Governor Northam in Virginia. And to the utter frustration of Trudy Munoz's lawyers, the Parole Board said they were going to look into it. And then it turned out who was the Parole Board investigator had a conflict of interest. And the case just seems to be sitting there with no one paying any attention to it. It really seems to me that Governor Northam's people should at least take a close look at this. Since Munoz was convicted, there have been more convictions overturned and more questions raised about shaken baby syndrome in terms of whether how easy or hard it is to tell that it's a cause of a child's injuries. Obviously, nobody wants children to be injured, and that's a very scary thing. But there was a kind of very righteous push to blame the last caregiver of a child when a child had abusive head trauma. And the medical opinion around that has been shifting, but not necessarily in a way yet that has helped this particular woman.
Oh, my God. I'm just looking. Sorry, I was listening to you, Emily, but I happened to be on the Washington Post website. And there's a story saying that Stormy Daniels' attorney will speak in Iowa, fueling speculation of possible presidential bid. Is that a joke? Are you kidding? Is this what we've come to? That some guy who's a lawyer for some random person in a scandal gets to run for president? That's ridiculous. John.
Although if we're going to talk about Stormy Daniels, the story of that crazy targeted arrest of her is just like really upsetting. Anyway, that's in Ohio, I think.
Yeah.
Sorry.
John, what's your chatter?
My chatter was that as I was thinking about this week's news and President Trump and Michael Cohen and whether it was important or where it fit in the scheme of things and all of that, I was reminded of that even given the fact that the president is associated with at least two cases of paying a great deal of money, at least in my view of things, $150,000 is a great deal of money, to two women to hush money, essentially, that he still, I don't think, an economist would have to calculate this in real dollars, but it still would not be, if those are the only amounts that he paid in hush money, would not be the historical leader in hush money payments to women with whom he had affairs. I should note quickly that he alleges that, or that he says that he did not have those affairs. But nevertheless, he did pay the hush money. So in that sense, it's apples to apples with Warren Harding. And that drove me to an article by Jordan Michael Smith in Politico from August of 2015, which is entitled America's Horniest President. I encourage everyone to read it because it's extraordinary the way Warren Harding behaved. We've had fun at Harding's expense rather regularly, I should say, on this show, because his letters to his various to the people with whom he had affairs, he was married, have been published. But I guess I didn't realize the extortion portion of it. So Carrie Phillips, which is one of his mistresses, was paid about $5,000 a month by the Republican National Committee. But then in the end, she was able to somehow finagle, in addition to those payments, a gift from the RNC of about $25,000. And so this article says basically—
Is that in 20s dollars? Or that's in—
Yeah.
Wow, that's in— that's a lot of money.
That's exactly right. And so the article calculates $25,000 from— 19, I guess this would have been 27, the 20s anyway, at about $300,000 today. So that's why I say that even just with Carrie Phillips, it would have been more than the totals that we know about from the president's hush money. But then also there's Nan Britton, with whom Harding used to have assignations in the closet, the coat closet of the White House, while a Secret Service officer watched guard outside and would knock on the door if Mrs. Harding was
wasn't
was
she
in the neighborhood.
The Secret Service officer in that case?
What's that?
Wasn't Nan Britton doing the Secret Service? But
anyway, Nan Britton was shamed. Harding dies. There's a baby. Basically, to make the money back, Britton writes a book. Everybody shames her and says she's making it all up. But then it was finally ultimately disclosed that Harding made secret child support payments until he died. And a DNA test was done that later proved that she, in fact, Nan Britton was right. Anyway, Warren Harding, what an amazing chapter in American history. Anyway,
are there descendants of that child? That child who was born in the 25?
That's a great question. I don't think there are descendants of Cleveland's love child, but I don't know in this case. One other thing I would like to recommend is the movie Eighth Grade, which Bo Burnham directed. It is a fantastic movie. The acting is just amazing. If you are a parent, it will be both revelatory and terrifying. And there's this one scene where Anne turned to me and said, "This may be the greatest scene I have ever witnessed." It has to do.
Oh my God! I can't wait to see this movie. That was such a good plug. Yeah.
It has to do with Chicken McNuggets or chicken nuggets.
And Dickerson.
The scene or the whole movie?
Yeah, but definitely see the whole movie. It's really well rendered.
All right, my chatter. And also I have a listener chatter too. So my chatter is also a recommendation of something to watch, which I don't think I've recommended before. Izzy tells me I haven't, which is Succession, this show on HBO. It's been sort of under the radar. It's a scenery chewing drama about the Murdoch family. It's about a media tycoon and his children, and the media tycoon who's gone into deep old age, but is still a lion. He is still a quite powerful lion, although fading in some ways. And the jockeying of his children, each more Learian, each more ruthless and terrible than the next. And it's great. There's amazing. Amazing scenery chewing, as I said, especially by Brian Cox as the patriarch. The settings are spectacular. There's a lot of wonderful failure. It reminds me a lot of a show I loved a few years ago called Kings, which was sort of a biblical retelling about Saul and David. And it's very similar in feel. So if you are somebody who liked Kings, you will definitely love Succession. And it has an incredible soundtrack. The best soundtrack of anything I've heard in years. So check it out. There again this week, you guys, listeners, you sent us amazing chatters. Please keep them coming.
Oh my God, they were so great.
They're so good. All of them were better than all of ours.
Totally
agree. Oh.
Throw in heat, but I think it's true. And really,
yes.
Really a bonus because there was a period there where things were fallow and really great.
Yeah. So you're sending it. So just to remind you, please tweet at us at Slate Gabfest with something you read, something you know about, something you learned about, something you've seen that's wonderful, strange, interesting, horrifying, magical, and most of all, worthy of discussion at a Bazelon cocktail party. And so again, as I said, there were just a ton of great ones. And maybe we'll post all of them in some fashion on the page somewhere. I don't know. I'm just speculating. But the one that I want to call out is from Christopher McCuba, who sent us a wonderful story from the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, which is it's one of these stories that begins one way and ends a different way. It's about a 13-year-old African-American child named Jaquan Faulkner, who set up Mr. Faulkner's old-fashioned hot dogs. He set up a hot dog stand in his neighborhood. And because people are jerks, someone, of course, called the health department on him. And was like, you know, don't sell your hot dogs, you little teenager. And so normally that ends one way. This time it ended a different way, which is that the city of Minneapolis and the health inspectors of Minneapolis were like, great, let's give you a quick course in sanitation and how to run a well-run hot dog stand, learn some food prep, and we'll pay for your permit. We'll pay for your vending permit. And so they paid for his vending permit. They trained him a little. And now he's taking his hot dog stand all around the city this summer and taking it to places like police stations and public parks. And it's a great story of entrepreneurship being recognized and appreciated. And so it was started grim and turned heartwarming. So thank you to Christopher for sending that our way. That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Danielle Hewitt and Jason DeLeon. Today, Jocelyn is elsewhere. Our researcher is Izzy Rode, today and all weeks. You can follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I am David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you next week.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS, we are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.